Hi, welcome to In the Key of History, a program designed to explore and shine a light on emerging and established musical talent in the Istri region. I'm your host, Randy Piercy. Hi, today we're going to deviate from our normal broadcast format, and I'm going to present to you an historical podcast that I developed through a grant from University of Bishop, the Blanchet Gardner Foundation, and the ETRC. There are four musical pieces in this historical podcast of significance to the date. Now, the piece centers around Canada's first steam buggy developed in Stansted by Henry Seth Taylor. The four pieces of music are The Blue Danube, which was actually composed in 1866, but first performed in 1867. Now, this song, 151 years old, has now become a almost standard repertoire in orchestral music. The recording is from an Edison wax cylinder dated from around 1902. The next song, or one of the songs, published in 1867 is The Maple Leaf Forever. It is written by Alexander Muir. It was basically the unofficial national anthem for a while, but because of the context of how the lyrics were written, it really wasn't popular with French Canada, but it is still being performed today with a much more inclusive version in the lyrics. The third song is The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze. The song was first published in 1867. The words were written by George Leyburn, music by Gaston Lear, and the arrangement by Alfred Lee. And it's centered around the story of Jules Lyotard, whose one-piece outfit is the leotard. And that's the origins of the word. This song is still being used again today and has been used ever since in many theatrical and musical performances. The fourth song is Johnny, I Hardly Knew Ye, which is a traditional song sang to when Johnny comes marching home. Now, it was first published in 1867 by Joseph B. Johagen. And from what I've read, the actual roots of the song go back well over 250 years. Now, the wording is very poignant, and at the time, I think it was taken as a little bit of a comical idea. But it is turned into a very, very powerful anti-war song. And again, this song is still being sung and performed by artists today. And there's two versions of this song. The traditional performance with a modern arrangement. And then at the very end of this podcast, you're going to hear an amazing freestyle by Jean-Olivier Bureau and Pixie Adams, which I recorded and just thought it was fantastic what they did. And with that, I present to you some history with music. The inspiration for this podcast came from a story told at a social gathering. An elder gentleman, Wally Moffat, recounted how a friend of his had found and hatched and raised a dozen wild turkey eggs. Everyone loved the story. The next day, I queried the group as to whether doing a series of podcasts on historical events in the townships would be of interest. The response was a resounding yes. This led to me contacting Jody Robinson, then archivist at Uplands Museum. We discussed topics, and she said that two items of historical importance for the year of 1867 occurred in the townships: the Stansted steam buggy and the Lady of the Lake steamship. After much searching and asking, I was led to apply to the ETRC for an historical grant. And there are many persons and institutions I need to thank for their help. I shall hopefully mention them all in the conclusion. I hope you enjoy. The year is 1867. This, a year of great historical importance for the world, for Canada, and for the Eastern Townships. The United States buys Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million, or about 2 cents an acre. Joseph Lister, aka Listerine, outlines the discovery of antiseptic surgery in the Lancet. Karl Marx's Das Kapital is published. The 15th and last shogun, Tokugawa Yoshinobu, resigns in Japan. Swedish chemist Alfred Nobel patents dynamite.
Blue Danube Waltz, played by the Edison Symphony Orchestra.
The Blue Danube, published in 1866, is performed for the first time in Vienna. The British North America Act is passed in the House of Commons and serves as Canada's constitution for more than 100 years. The Dominion of Canada is formed, comprising the provinces of New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Ontario, and Quebec, with Sir John A. Macdonald serving as the first Prime Minister. With the establishment of the British North American Act, Canada acquires self-government from Britain. Canada's first national anthem, The Maple Leaf Forever, is published. And in a small corner of Canada, then known as Stansted Plain, a young inventor debuts Canada's first horseless steam carriage. This young inventor, Henry Seth Taylor, an unassuming and quiet man, shall not only create our first taste of mobile freedom, but will also produce a number of devices that still have relevance today. But first, who was Henry Taylor? Henry Seth Taylor was born on April 9, 1831, to Reuben and Jane Taylor. One of six children, he showed mechanical aptitude at an early age. I recently had the opportunity to interview Kathy Curtis, archivist at the Colby Curtis Museum in Stansted, Quebec.
What was the early life of Henry Seth Taylor? What was it like?
He grew up on a farm outside of Stansted. That's the one detail that his dad owned the farm. And other than that, he went at a young age. I think he was a man that, or a young boy, who knew he wanted to play with things and build things and do things, take things apart. The one thing I did find that at a very young age, he went to Boston and did an apprenticeship as a watchmaker. I've tried to do a lot of research for this, and there's not a lot written about Mr. Taylor, but there is, I don't know if it's an urban legend, or I couldn't find the actual fact that he walked there. So I'm wondering rather it was one of these things where he struck off for Boston, he walked and maybe got rides or different ways, but if he actually walked all the way, I can't answer that. I mean, it's a 4.5-5 hour drive by car. Right. So I can't even imagine back in 1850-ish walking all the way. So I think probably it was one of these things where he walked and rode and maybe got rides on wagons, and it might have taken some time.
In 1931... reporter Lee Quimby wrote from an interview with Mr. George Bailey, Mr. Taylor's half-brother, who had lived and worked with H.S. Taylor, as a young man was apprenticed to a skilled watchmaker at Stansted, where he learned and became master of his trade. I wonder what Henry Seth Taylor would think.
Now, who told you that story? Sounds like there's a few wagging tongues in this family. You want to hear it then? Fine, I'll tell you. I'll start by telling you why I did it. I was 8, maybe 9 at the time, working for my father, just like you work for yours, like all good sons do. That's what we're taught. But one day I decided I didn't like the work. It was the same thing every day, and it wasn't good enough for me. I told my father as much. Do you know what he said? As long as you live under my roof, you'll do what I tell you. Otherwise, you're free to go and find your own work. You've probably heard something like that from your father, too. The difference is, that wasn't good enough for me. So I left. We were just by the border with America, and I'd been across once or twice, so it made sense to cross over. I walked for days. I just packed a little bit of bread in a tiny bag hung over a stick, so I was hungry for most of that walk. All the way to Boston I went. Now, the actual walk was no adventure. Besides a great view of the stars every night, there's nothing really worth mentioning. But once I made it to Boston, I did exactly as my father told me. I went about finding my own work. I don't remember how many people I asked. Every single one of them turned me away or tried to help me find my parents. I even had to flee one of them when he tried to drag me to the police station. I asked over and over again until I found the man who'd make me work. He was a watchmaker, the kind of man who doesn't ask too many questions. The simple fact was he needed an apprentice, and he never had any sons. I learned a lot from that man. I inherited his steady hands, he gifted me with his facility with tools, and just the shred of knowledge I could glean from him was enough to set me up for life. When I came back here, I felt like nothing would stop me. You do something like that, you can do anything. Oh, you like that story, eh? It's a good one. Well, that's all it is. A story. The family likes to tell it over and over again to whoever will listen. I learned everything I needed to know here. It was hard work and vision that got me to where I am now, not some family legend, not some impossible walk to another country to train under some wizened old mentor. If you learn anything from this story, boy, it's the trust in the sweat of your brow. There's nothing that can propel a man to the greatest of achievements besides hard work and knowledge. So seek out the knowledge you need and work to apply it.
Typically, a watchmaker's apprenticeship would have been at least 7 years. Also of note, the first mass-manufactured watch factory was started in Roxbury, Massachusetts, in 1850. The pocket watch at the time would have contained hundreds up to 1,000 parts, and a watchmaker would have had to know how to fabricate each piece. What is known is that at age 25, he was initiated into the Masonic Lodge of Stansted, Golden Rule Lodge No. 5. In the lodge documents that survive, he was initiated on September 22, 1856, and his occupation is listed as jeweler. Mr. Taylor appears to have been a person of many talents.
He owned the jewelry store, of course, for a short period of time, and he was also very interested in escorting people on hunting trips and fishing trips near the Lake Megantic area. He also was a photographer, and I do have in our collection a few photographs that he took of these groups, hunting and fishing and camping. So that was a big thing for him. And he also just continuously build different things and make different things. I don't think he ever was really all that interested in presenting them or having them be a thing. I think it was just his thing to build and discover, and that was his interest.
Appearing in the Stansted Journal starting in September of 1858 are advertisements that read,
"Look here, if you want the best ambrotype, photograph, and melanotype ever made in this country, call at H.S. Taylor's Saloon."
By 1863, the run of the saloon business was over as another photographer, an O.C. Bolton, advertised,
"Ambrotypes and photographs at reduced prices. Call at the saloon formerly owned by H.S. Taylor."
During this early period, it married a Miss Susanna Rogers. It is presumed she died at a young age. Sometime between 1863 and 1865, he remarried to a Miss Jeanette Clark, 12 years younger than himself. Their first child, Harriet, was born in 1865. It was during this period that he started on one of his most significant inventions, the steam buggy. But we shall return to this later. On January 8, 1866, he files his first and only known patent in Ontario. This patent was for the boiler he was to use in his steam carriage and later in his steamship, the Gracie.
Superheated steam generator.
In his patent submission, the point of interest is the manner with which the water is converted to steam. The water is pumped into a pipe that sits centered in the boiler. This pipe has bulbs or bulges which convert the pumped water into fine jets. The pipe is surrounded by a cage of fine wire which further atomizes the water before it is vaporized into superheated steam of
great elasticity.
The benefits of a steam generator's method of conversion are said to be
much increasing the power of the engine with a great decrease in fuel and water, and also at much less cost of building the same, and also being entirely safe from danger of explosion, as the water only enters as just as required by the engine.
The first report of a steam carriage appears in the Stansted Journal on September 12th of 1867.
This mechanical curiosity is the neatest thing of kind yet invented. The whole carriage, engine and boiler weighing only 500 pounds. The boiler is made of steel, 16 inches in diameter and 30 inches high, consists of 207 5/8 flues 9 inches long. The engine is two brass cylinders, 3.5-inch bore by 10-inch stroke, working direct to the wheels by cranks in the simplest of manners.
The local blacksmith, Joseph Mosher, was employed to reinforce the carriage with iron fittings and braces. The maximum speed was given as 15 miles per hour, this being the speed of a horse at gait, but a horse would need to be rested after 15 miles. In Lee Quimby's article circa 1931, it was described as such. The boiler was attached to the rear of the carriage, the water tank with a 6-gallon capacity to the front axle, and the two connected by two rubber tubes through which water was pumped to the boiler by an ordinary pump. The boiler contained about 100 small flues and was operated at 60 pounds pressure. The two cylinders of the engine were attached to the forward and inside ends of the wagon reaches, and the piston rods connected with crankshafts on the hind axle. Collars fitted to the hind axle trees with ratchet attachment served as compensators in rounding corners or turning about, either going forward or backwards. In other words, affording free and independent movement of each wheel in its revolution. A lever running from the throttle valve to the driver's seat enabled the driver to control the movements of the wagon forward and backwards by simply twisting it to the right or left, as the case may be, or shutting off power by bringing it to neutral. The steering device consisted of a cog bar attached to the front axle and extending well back to the end of the carriage, and connected to this was a vertical rod running up to the driver's seat with a cog wheel attachment at the point of contact with the horizontal rod. To the top of the vertical rod was attached a crank which enabled the driver to guide the car to the right or left or straight away. As the car was not designed for hill climbing, it had no brakes. This one oversight would prove later to be its near demise. The Stansted Journal in September of 1867 reports,
H.S. Taylor's steam carriage is completed and will be at the Stansted Fair during the 3 days of exhibit, where it will run with any trotting horse that can be produced, and will probably show some fast time.
And again, on the last day of the fair, September 19th, 1867.
On the last day of the fair, it was expected to add to the attractions of the day by the exhibition of a very ingenious steam carriage by Mr. H.S. Taylor of this town. But having delayed the completion of it until prior to the fair, it was found to be impossible to remedy some defect in the engine in season to use it. This, with the breaking down of the carriage, was contretemps detracting from the occasion.
Gather round, please, gather round. Welcome to the 1867 Stansted Fall Fair. Behold, the advent of the horseless carriage, a true marvel of technological achievement. This is the future of transportation. No tricks, no subterfuge. What, as a simple pull of a lever, is sufficient to propel the carriage onto the field. Fueled by coal, powered by steam, this carriage can rival a horse at a trot. A comfortable ride can be achieved at any pace, up to the most breakneck speeds. Not to worry, just a small setback that can be repaired. The great thing about a carriage such as this, it's much easier to fix than a horse. Now, let's see what's wrong with you. What's going on? Easy to repair. Unless a hose ruptures and throws steam just about everywhere. No, this won't do. I can't drive the carriage now. I'll have to push it off the field. What a failure. What a disappointment. 2 years. And for what? Now, obviously it needs a few adjustments, but still, this is an achievement of personal locomotion. Imagine the future of this kind of technology. Trust me, friends, this is not the end of the horseless carriage. No, not the end at all. I haven't spent 2 years on this invention to let it fester and rot after a single setback. No, I'll be back. I'll show them what this technology can achieve. They have no idea.
Unfortunately, the carriage had suffered a steam hose rupture. But this was soon remedied, and Mr. Taylor was seen driving his carriage frequently around the townships and northern Vermont. So common became the sight that the following year at the fair, the Stansted Journal reported,
Mr. Taylor exhibited his steam wagon.
And that was all. Mr. Taylor continued to exhibit his steam carriage at events throughout eastern Canada and northern U.S., frequently receiving a small remuneration for his display. And how was Henry's steam carriage perceived? Henry's grandson, Henry Adams, writes in a letter that, My grandfather's inventions were not much esteemed by his family. I think Grandma Taylor felt that the steam wagon was an embarrassment to the family, making him something of a laughingstock. During a fair at St. Johnsbury, Vermont, about 45 miles south of Stansted Plain, he scared the horses and old ladies. It was suggested he be sued as a public nuisance.
How was his steam buggy received?
That's kind of an amusing story, actually. He took it to the Stansted County Exhibition, and apparently he drove into the fairgrounds, and everything went wrong. Totally everything went wrong. A hose broke, and it covered the buggy with steam and water and himself, and people just laughed at him, totally laughed at him, booed him, and not one person in the audience would help him push the buggy off the fairgrounds. So there's all these little legends or stories about him being in the countryside and driving too fast and people just being in wonder of what this thing was. We have to remember that nobody had ever seen anything like this before. So he was kind of laughed at, but I think also a little bit admired because he was known as a very gentle and kind person and would help his neighbor at any time. So I think they tried to show interest and not be terribly amused at some of his things, but the steam engine just couldn't figure out what he was trying to do with all of this.
Henry and Jeanette's second child, Charles Henry, was born in 1869 at his father's old house near Derby Line, some 400 yards from the border with Canada. Henry moved from Derby Line to Stansted. He had purchased several properties and built a house. The house was completed in 1870 and the Taylor family and the servants moved in. This house still survives to this day in what is now named Maple Road in Stansted. Advertisements in the Stansted Journal indicate that he operated a jewelry and watch shop on the border of U.S. and Canada. These advertisements appear from 1869 until 1871 when he sells the shop to a Mr. Parsons. Mr. Taylor continued to use his carriage over the next several years. Then, in the summer of 1875 or 1876, Mr. Taylor crashed his carriage. Traveling downhill, Henry lost control of his vehicle, and the carriage landed on its side at the bottom of the hill.
Now, I must have gone over hills like that nearly 100 times. It was the talk of the town back then, that carriage. Every time I drove it, I'd hear about it for days. There's a certain pride in that, I'll admit. Until that one day, when I went over the hill. There was nothing particularly remarkable about it, no name that I can really recall. All I know is that, on that day, the buggy had its own plans, and they were set in motion the moment the thing went over the hill. The buggy started to pick up speed like nothing I'd felt, and the thing was already pretty quick. It really was something. Nowhere near as fast as a horse at full gallop, not as smooth either, but to whip by people at that speed with nothing but the power of steam and coal was a feeling truly unlike any other. But I never felt speed like I did on that day. I went over the hill too quickly. A part of me enjoyed the feeling at first. I felt a great vigor in that speed. I was sure no one had ever gone that fast before. But that vigor quickly sank in my guts, hardening into dread. You know, man is an animal, like all God's creatures, and animals trust their instincts. Those instincts screamed at me that day. They screamed that the buggy was going too fast, that I was in danger. Now tell me, what do you do when a horse panics and picks up too much speed? You pull the reins until it slows down. But the buggy didn't have anything like reins. It's not something that ever occurred to me, and even if it had, how would you implement something like that? It was faster than I ever even thought could be possible. But as remarkable as that speed was, It wasn't what I was thinking about at the time. I was thinking about my life, the danger I was in. I remember the headline flashing in my head, Invention Kills Inventor, or something along those lines. Would have been a pretty catchy headline, but unfortunately for the reporters, God had other plans. Even as the buggy raced for the creek, I threw myself clear. Still don't know how I managed it. I'd never done anything like that in my life. Tumbling through the rocks and dirt was far from pleasant, and I ripped my suit, but I suffered no injury of the body. Nothing serious anyway. I could only watch as the buggy careened off the path, smashing into the creek. I don't think I'll ever drive the thing again. The boiler's intact, and I'm not sure the rest of the buggy's in any shape to be useful. It's in the barn, where it'll stay. I could rebuild it, maybe even figure out a way to include reins of some kind that would stop the machine, but I won't. Now, I have no intention of building anything like that ever again.
The next day, Mr. Taylor returned to the crash site and retrieved his broken carriage. The pieces were brought back home and reused. Two wheels were repurposed to use in a boat hauler. The boiler was installed in his new boat, the Gracie, and the rest was stored in the barn loft. Fortunately, this is not the end of the steam carriage's fate. The remains sat in the barn loft for another 85 years, and sometime around 1960, a Mrs. Gertrude Abbott Soudan purchased the Taylor family farm and properties from Henry's grandson, Henry Adam Taylor. He had inherited the properties from his uncle, Oscar Caswell, in 1948. Gertrude offered the pieces to the Stansted Historical Society, but they were not interested at the time. The cost of a restoration would have been prohibitive. In that same year, Gertrude found a buyer in a Mr. Richard M. Stewart, an antique car collector and then president of Anaconda American Brass. Mr. Stewart spent 4 years having the carriage recrafted. Mr. Hoops fabricated new wheels. The new wheels were 16-spoke as compared to the original 14-spoke, but these have since been replaced with a 14-spoke wheel. The piston valves, the drive rods, and crankshaft were cleared of rust and refitted. The brass cylinders were checked for cracks and then polished. The engine, after cleaning, ran without any parts needing to be replaced. This is a testament to the precision and quality of Mr. Taylor's work. The seats and dashboard were recovered in leather. All the wooden parts were scraped, sanded, repainted, and then striped. A new boiler was fabricated to match the original. Only one addition was made. Brakes were added. And on sunny days near Waterbury, Connecticut, the carriage would run short trips on the compressed air. On the very rare occasion the boiler was fired up, the carriage's steam whistle could be heard a mile away. Mr. Stewart eventually loaned the carriage to the Ontario Centre for Science and Technology in the year of 1867, our centennial. In 1983, it was purchased from Mr. Stewart by the Canadian Science and Technology Museum, and the carriage is now in storage. Mr. Taylor went on to develop other inventions, a talking machine, a fold-down sofa bed, and had a partial patent in the Reese buttonholer. The partial patent was later converted into shares in the Reese Buttonhole Machine Company. The sofa bed and talking machine are now in the Colby Curtis Museum in Stansted, Quebec. His purchase and retrofit of the Gracie steamship in 1877 allowed him to offer excursions on Lake Memphremagog. He owned the ship until his untimely death in 1887. The Stansted Journal reported,
Mr. Henry S. Taylor, a well-known resident of Stansted Plain, died quite suddenly of erysipelas on Sunday evening. It is supposed he became inoculated with the disease while attending Mr. Squire Taylor, who was first taken with the disease but is now convalescent. There are one or two said to have the disease, but in a milder form.
4 days after his death, the Stansted Journal reported,
Mrs. H.S. Taylor and daughter, Miss Taylor, are ill with erysipelas.
Johnny, I hardly knew ya. with your drums and guns and guns and drums, hurroo, hurroo. With your drums and guns and guns and drums, hurroo, hurroo. With your drums and guns and guns and drums, the enemy nearly slew, yeah. Oh, darling dear, you look so queer. And Johnny, I hardly knew you.
As can be heard, there is no consistent personal historical information on Henry Seth Taylor. Then, there are the inconsistencies in the details of his steam buggy. Many articles and research papers neglect to mention or know of his patents. And some historians believe his steamship Gracie was named after his daughter. But in fact, the ship was named 2 years before her birth. This leaves the listener to draw their own conclusion on some of the events of his life. From his steam carriage, steam engine, talking machine, and fold-down sofa bed, we can glean an insight into his motivations. Mr. Taylor was a very creative and hardworking individual, a continuous inventor and fabricator. The co-patent of the Reese buttonholer shows an understanding of the mechanical process, even at an industrial scale. Where would such ideas come from? Henry was a quiet and contemplative man who enjoyed the serenity of the outdoors. This has been the arena of inspiration for many great inventors. And being a Mason would have afforded him a sphere of influence and connection far beyond the smaller geographies of the Eastern Townships. It is unfortunate we don't have more historical evidence to complete the picture of Mr. Taylor's legacy. However, we can garner from what exists that he was a kind and considerate man, determined and selfless in the giving of his own health and life to care for others. I would like to thank the following: Jody Robinson and the ETRC for help and guidance, and the Belanger Gardner Foundation for the research grant. Kathy Curtis, archivist at the Colby Curtis Museum, and the extensive list of articles and papers at the Colby Curtis Museum and the Stansted Historical Society. Masonic Lodge Golden Rule No. 5 of Stansted, Quebec. Nicholas Boucher for his research, scripting, and portrayal of Henry Taylor. Jean-Olivier Bureau and Annika Proust Adams for their musical research, arranging, and performances of Those Amazing Men and Johnny, I Hardly Knew You, both published in 1867. Etienne Dominique for voicing the Stansted Journal. Wax Cylinder Music, The Blue Danube and the Maple Leaf Forever from the University of California, Santa Barbara Library. The Townshippers Association and Colby Ingham from Yes, Montreal. And Rachel Gervais Cripps for founding the Magog Social Club and affording a place of leisure and acceptance for those of us new to the community. Wally Moffat for his amazing storytelling. And I, Randy Piercy, did the research, scripting, recording, narration, Foley construction, and editing of this podcast. I would like to leave you with a modern rendition of Johnny, I Hardly Knew You by Jean-Olivier Bureau and Annika Proust Adams. Thank you.
Johnny, 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 oh Johnny, I hardly knew you when going. going the road to sweet heaven. Sticking me and the dropping me high. A doleful damsel I heard cry. Oh, Johnny.
So, that's our program for this week. I hope you enjoyed that historical podcast. And if you know any musicians or people that are working with music, please have them contact us so that we can do an interview and showcase their talent or their research or what they're composing. Thank you. Have a great day.